This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
And now, a yak.
Yak!
Welcome, everybody, to this week's edition of the Ticket City Podcast. I'm Jeff Ketchum of OrangeBloods.com, joined, as always, by most of the Orange Bloods crew. No Alex today, which means no Alex rant. Well, maybe I can fill the void, or Dustin, or Jason, or even Anwar. That would be fabulous. But the rest of the gang, as I just mentioned, Anwar, Dustin, Jason, all here. Fellas, greetings and all of those fine things. It occurred to me as I was getting ready to, put together what we would talk about today. We're less than 2 weeks. We're 11 days away from the start of spring football. It's interesting because we are in the middle of the dead season, but I think we're about to get a reprieve from that. And never have I, this morning, because on Sunday I had a hard time thinking about what to write about. So to be close to spring football feels like a reprieve against this kind of silence, other than an occasional analyst being hired and what's going on in recruiting. Anwar, you stand to be the one that will do the most work during spring football with the media availabilities and everything else going on. Have you found yourself looking forward to the fact that we are now less than 2 weeks away from the start of something that we won't totally be able to enjoy because we don't get full access and all of those things?
Yes. I mean, it's still in a weird way, even though there's not what you would consider, something to cover or an event to cover. I've still been busy. I've still been able to still have news. It seems like every week there's something newsy that breaks, whether it's the analysts or now we look at injury from Brandon Jones. So there is honestly, I always feel like there's something going on at all times, still have war room, this and that. But, like anything, when you get into spring football or even the regular season, for me, it's more about a schedule and the kind of more of a predictable schedule. But I still feel like every day I'm doing something though.
Yeah, but it's boring. analyst stuff is boring. The honest to goodness football stuff, I think, is what I've been missing, Jason, since, the last thing we had was the greatest football moment in almost a decade for the Texas football program. And then it's kind of cold turkey after that. So it's fascinating that the timing, because this was a season that had some weird little turns and twists. And then to get to the end and have that big emphatic walk off, it left me wanting more. And I found myself, I think, just wanting more actual Texas football. I want more games. I want to watch the young guys play more. And I think I've been, there's been an emptiness. And to be fair, I had a really, Anwar unknowingly stole my Sunday column idea. And Jason can attest to this. Not that Anwar took my idea. I'm just volunteering that up. I literally had no lead for my column. I sent Jason my column at about 7:30 at night. And I was like, hey, go ahead and give it a read. But I still don't know what my lead is going to be. And then I thought of spring football. And I was like, well, that's actually close enough away that we can start to look ahead a little bit to that. But yes, Anwar, you're right. It has been very newsy. We had you had the breaking news yesterday. Nice job, by the way, about Brandon Jones's surgery, which I think is an interesting thing that we can talk about, because it does, at least for the foreseeable future, open up a spot for a young player to kind of make his presence felt during the spring and in the offseason, where it might not have otherwise been there, at least in terms of working with the first team. All of the analysts, positions that have been filled. And I think that's kind of interesting, just because, am I crazy, or did Texas just bring in four analysts who are way overqualified for analyst positions? Anwar, is this about benefits for all four of these guys? How did they get a bunch of coordinators and former, legit six-figure guys in positions that, typically pay like $25,000 a year?
Well, I think 3 out of 4 because one of the guys was Fedora's son, and he was like a he was like a quality control guy or something like that. So I so the other three, right? You can say, and it just seems like Herman. I feel like as Herman is grown more comfortable in his role and in his skin, he can kind of flex a little bit more. And now, especially being able to address certain areas and certain issues, it just seems like the analyst thing is one of these things he looked at in the offseason and said, okay, how can I improve that area and make it stronger? And again, yes, for sure, for some of it, it's the benefit of saying, I'm getting paid X amount of money from this other school. I don't want to rush and just take a job and be in some directional place. I mean, you know, college sports, man. I mean, not every city's a great city. You know, there's Austin, and then there's a lot of other places that you got to convince the family to move to. Easier to sell here. So you come here, you still get paid. You can still help out. You can still do a lot of different things. Then you wait your time. And then, you know, come December, you can see what's open and you can move on from there. If not, you stay here.
Fedora's son has to be like moving on up to East Side. He finally got a piece of the pie. Like that's a big move for him. That gets him, I think, you know, from quality control to analyst to, I think the next gig for him is probably a real coaching job.
Well, the smart part. But the smart part on Herman's thing is when he says, okay, you know, I want Larry Fedora here, and you know, he sweetens the pot a little bit because he's like, hey, you know, does your son want to come here? I mean, and clearly, I'm sure his son is qualified. So I'm not saying he just threw the guy a bone for the guy that doesn't deserve it, but it definitely sweetens the pot, you know, for that guy who. I've heard that is, you know, he's got a daughter who's a junior in high school. So I don't believe that she's leaving high school. And so she may stay up there with the wife. So this actually gives Larry the opportunity to come here with his son. He's got a dad who actually lives in College Station. So it kind of looks like it's going to be like kind of a bromance here over in Austin. But it gives that family still some connectivity as they're going. Looks like the strong possibility that they're going to be apart.
Dustin, spring football. I'm curious, and I want to hear everybody's answer on this. Give me a couple of names of guys, non, like all Big 12 guys that are returning. So not Sam, not Caden Stearns, not even BJ Foster. Give me the guys that you're, and they're all probably going to be young, but certainly it could be an older player. Like, who are you most low-key looking forward to watching in a couple of weeks or hearing about or just following their progress to see if the proverbial light switch kicks in?
Funny you say that. It's exactly what I wrote about on Wednesday. I give you three guys on defense and three guys on offense. On defense, Moro, Jomo. I think people still don't realize how young he is. I mean, this is a guy that's still 17 years old. He's not going to turn 18 until August. And you could see, I think Herb Hamm posted a picture recently of a group that won a workout deal or something like that. And you see him in the top corner and you're like, oh my gosh, that guy's 17. Like, that's crazy. And just, you know, going back to when he was signed, I remember Tom Herman saying that he'd never seen a guy make the kind of jump from a junior to senior season that a Jomo did. And sometimes when you get these guys that are relatively new to football and have kind of diverse backgrounds, they often rapidly improve like quicker, especially as it relates to other guys of their age group that have been playing football a longer time. So I'm really fired up about watching him. I loved him as a recruit. His tape was fantastic. I thought it was a huge get for Texas then. And they need him. They need guys like him or somebody to emerge along that defensive line. Joseph Asai might be kind of cheating because he came on really well at the end of last season. But, I mean, he wasn't like an all-conference guy. They've got to find people that can consistently get after the quarterback. And I think that he's the best suited to do that of anybody on the roster. I think if he has a really, really good spring – and gets closer to being poised for that breakout sophomore season, that would be a big development for Texas. And then DeMar beyond Overshown, especially now with the news about Brandon Jones being out for the spring, this is an opportunity for him to get in there. And, you know, as Anwar mentioned in one of his recent Sunday columns, it seems like the coaching staff is very aware that this is a guy that needs to get on the field because he's kind of like B.J. Foster. He can do a lot of things. He's very, very physical. You can play him down at the line of scrimmage. You can play him maybe in a linebacker type role. You can play him at safety. You can kind of move him all over the place. And while that safety position is loaded, he's now going to have a great opportunity this spring now that Jones isn't going to be out there with any snaps. And then on the offensive side, two offensive linemen, Christian Jones and Reese Moore. Jones is kind of like a Jomo, and a guy that's pretty new to football still, that had the soccer background, didn't really play football seriously until later into his high school career. A super athlete. I think the soccer background helped him with his footwork and his, you know, his feet. I mean, he's a guy that caught Alex's attention immediately during one of the preseason practices. I'm excited to see what happens with him. And then Reese Moore, I love guys like him with their frame that have a basketball background, especially a basketball background to where he was like a legitimately good high school basketball player. And often when you see that sort of size and length in athleticism, it just reminds me of the type of lineman that, you know, Iowa and Wisconsin get, and they throw a red shirt on, and then you look up a couple years later in the program, it's like, oh, they have another guy that's going to go early in the NFL draft. And I'm not saying that's going to happen with Moore, but he kind of fits that mold in terms of that prototype for a guy that you throw some weight on, you redshirt, he's got the basketball background, he's got the feet, then he could potentially turn into a difference maker. And he kind of reminds me some of Samuel Cosmi as well in terms of his physical stature and his traits. And then Brennan Eagles. I mean, if you listed the most talented receiver on the team, I mean, if he's not at the top of the list, he's very, very, very close to being at the top of the list. And with Little Jordan Humphrey moving on, there's going to be some open snaps there. Of course, with Colin Johnson and Devin Duvernay both back, there's seemingly not a ton of snaps. But this is a guy that, you know, they put out there a little bit last season. He seemed to be at the top or you know, right there with Malcolm Epps in the pecking order for those big receiver snaps for those freshman guys. So I'm curious to see if he starts to put it together more and starts to have some production that matches all those great physical traits.
Anwar, same question to you.
This is like the second straight week that you're asking me a question for something I have prepared for the war room. So it's like, it's
so you want to pass? You can pass.
I will just say that, it doesn't matter because Dustin's already hit on a lot of them. The only ones I'll add to it from some of my people in the building. So this will go just beyond my only thoughts and observations. The first name that was rattled off to me was Taequann Graham, as a guy that they,
my know, man, all right, Taequann. Yeah.
So that was the first name that I heard as far as people that they, you know, looking at, wanting, you know, hoping take a next step. Now, clearly, they want everyone to take another step, right? So it would be kind of the ideal is everyone progresses. But I'm just talking about, I asked for specifics, and that was a name that was thrown at me. Deshaun Jameson was another one. You know, clearly just trying to find some people in that DB. Who's going to fill in at the cornerback position. So, of course, Jalen Green is another guy that was thrown out there. Anthony Cook. Of course, you know, Dustin already touched on Morrow. And of course, Deli. The only other name that he didn't mention that was mentioned to me, which is going to be a no-brainer, is Gerald Wilbon. And he, of course, needing some guys in the defensive line. That's the concern. You know, it's when you look at that defense catch and you're essentially saying – you have what, maybe two returning starters with Caden Stearns and Brandon Jones, and the rest is just a lot of question marks. And not to say like a guy like Malcolm Roach isn't good or anything to that effect, but because of that, you know, that there are going to be, you're going to have to keep your eyes on a lot of different people in the spring.
Jason, if there's any other name that hasn't been mentioned, feel free to throw that one in. I wanted to follow that up with this question, though. Isn't it weird that there's nothing quarterback-wise? There's not – like, we're going to watch how Casey Thompson develops, and, of course, we'll watch Sam. Oh, what's going on? someone dropped their computer.
Someone has a typewriter?
That was me typing. Sorry, I dropped my call. But
God, are you pounding it with your fist?
My mic's just right by my keyboard. But
we heard that. but like this is a weird. It feels like every spring and every summer and every fall camp and everything that could be going on for the last decade has been obsessed with answers at quarterback and who can be the quarterback and who's going to win the job. And we go into this spring with the starter is absolutely the starter. And fate has deemed that the backup job is basically the backup job. This could have been Cameron Rising versus Casey Thompson as a spring battle would have been, I think, a really big talking point. And yet, we're going to go into this spring, and I feel like those two guys get to put their work in without a ton of obsession surrounding the position the way that it probably has been since Colt McCoy left in at the end of the 2009 season. Mic drop.
Yeah, I missed half the conversation. So
it was your question.
My internet dropped, dude. We need to chop this one up. That's what I was sending you a message. I've missed the last 5 minutes of this conversation. So.
Oh. Well, fair enough. Well, here's the question again. I was just
something about quarterbacks. I got that part.
Yeah, I was just saying that it's a little strange to go into this camp where the starting job is absolutely locked up. The backup job for the time being is absolutely Casey Thompson's. I would expect him to get all of the second team reps for the most part. So these guys are going to be able to put their work in without us obsessing on a practice report. You know what I mean? Like, who looked good? It's day two. Sam had the better day. Day three, I think Bouchel completed 3 more percentage of his passes. And, you know, like there's been like that level of obsession, I think, from day to day. Whereas I think this year, a lot of the focus in terms of day in and day out, what's happening kind of a thing won't be at the quarterback position. It's just a bit of a change for us.
Well, it seems like it's been years since we haven't been. And I mean, last year we
pretty much knew.
Well, yeah, 10 years. We knew last year was Sam's job, really contrary to what, you know, they didn't announce it for a while, but we were still tracking who's doing well each day and who's getting, you know, Shane's getting, he got the first team reps at the scrimmage, you know, the first series with the first team. And that was interesting when that type of thing happened. But yeah, this spring, I mean, you'll have some of that discussion, I think, with Casey Thompson and Roschon Johnson. But, you know, to me, I think you would agree, Ketch, based on what you were saying. I mean, it's settled. I mean, it's obviously Sam number one. I don't see Roschon pushing Casey Thompson. I think Roschon's a fantastic player, but he's going to need a little bit of time in this system and at this level and just to fine tune some things. So, you know, I think the bigger quarterback story, this will be as well as Sam played last year. Can he even take that next step towards greatness? I mean, is he playing at a tremendously high level this spring? And then the bigger question to me, I don't really have any concerns with Sam Ehlinger. So the bigger quarterback story for me, how is Casey Thompson playing? Because there's a really good chance he's going to be needed at some point. Is he capable of going in and winning football games and leading this offense if he has to play, you know, one game, start a game, play 2-3 games? Who knows? So to me, that's almost the bigger quarterback storyline. How is Casey Thompson performing this spring? Is he not making mistakes? Is he moving the offense up and down the field against the defense? You know, I think his development is maybe even a bigger story than whatever happens with Sam. I mean, you know what you're going to get with Sam, and he's going to play well. But Texas needs Casey Thompson to play well. He's going to get a lot of work this spring. You said it. He'll get all the number two reps. Hell, I might even give him some time with the number ones from time to time. You know, him taking that next step forward with his progress will be key in this program's development next year because he's going to be needed at some point.
Anwar, your thoughts on the quarterbacks?
Damn it, I had it on mute.
You know what?
Not
you
the smoothest still, podcast that we've
you,
had.
But you were still within the window that you could have not said that, and I think you still would have been okay.
It sounded like you were pondering the question for a second.
Yes, and then, so if you'd just gone into the answer, we would have never known. But, yeah, I think it's happened to everybody so far.
Yeah.
I didn't do it as it was, but, yeah.
I do agree with Jason, though. I mean, it's, you know, you've seen over the past couple of years that look, Sam Ehlinger, because of the style of football that he plays, and it leads to injury. And it's not to say you can't get injured any other way, but that style of play is going to be open them up for more. So I think what Jason said is correct. You definitely want to know what Casey is doing and how he's progressing, because let's not forget that last year, Casey Thompson was number four in the depth chart. I mean, he just was. He was behind Shane. He was behind Cameron Rising. And so now he's a guy that is now number two on the depth chart. So he's number two by default. But what we have to see, and what would be interesting to see, is can he develop and progress into a quarterback that if Sam goes out, you still have a chance to win. You still have an opportunity to win. Now, look, I know the people in the building are very high on him. They feel very confident with him and feel confident in his ability. But you still got to see it, right? You still got to see it in live time. You got to see it when the bullets are flying and all those other type of things. So, like Jason, you know, not expecting much from Roshan this year. Still think pegging him as this a developmental year. Still thinking that this is probably a redshirt season for him. The good part is, outside of when we get past that, the good part is Texas still has a quarterback that is arguably the best quarterback in the Big 12. I think a safe argument could be made that he's better than Jalen Hurts. You may not want to hear it, Ketch, but I think a safe argument and an argument could be made that he's a better quarterback than Jalen Hurts is. So the good part for Texas is they
have. Why would I not want to hear that?
You may not. I don't know. I know you feel strongly about Jalen Hurts as a QB, so I don't.
I think he's good.
Okay. I don't mean it as you are president of his fan club, but you're very complimentary of him.
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah.
Like the people in Vegas have him as the fourth favorite to win the Heisman ahead of Sam. I personally don't think he's better than Sam, but he's good.
Okay, so fair enough. And that's the one thing that Texas does have that, you know, that works to their favor and works to their benefit, at least in the quarterback room, is, like, as you said, Ketch, it's kind of the first offseason where you definitely know who the quarterback is. There are no questions about it. And now it's just about what else, you know, is going to happen around that guy.
Well, Anwar, it's also interesting that Sam gets to breathe a little bit. And, you know, I think him and Shane both probably felt like they had to prove things that it hadn't, you know what I mean? Like, there was still this motivation that those two guys had to compete. And we always talk about alpha male stuff and Sam's personality, but it's a hell of a thing when a quarterback is the undisputed leader of a team, and then he gets a full year of kind of putting his personality into what that means. I'm curious to hear, you know, it's unfair for Shay or for Sam to be compared to Colt McCoy and Vince Young. But you know, that's, if you eliminate the last 10 years, like, though, that's the bar. The last two quarterbacks that, were really, really good around here that both had their numbers retired, were guys that were legendary for what they were doing behind the scenes during the offseason. I mean, Vince Young and Colt McCoy really put their fingerprints on teams. I know we've talked in the past, like, look, one of the reasons why they haven't necessarily wanted to do a ton of 7-on-7 in the summer and all of that is because Tom wants, you know, to them to be in control. And he hasn't necessarily wanted his, you know, some of the upperclassmen that he's had to kind of maybe have control that he doesn't want them to have. But I feel like we may be entering this new era. And I think we've talked about this on the podcast where Tom might like change that a little bit now that he has the dude and that the dude is so comfortable in that kind of role. I'm not trying to put pressure on Sam. I'm curious to hear as we go through this entire off season, how he kind of expands his presence, because I think this team needs that. I think Baker Mayfield did that for Oklahoma, and I think Kyler Murray did that for Oklahoma. And for Texas to have a guy that can be that guy, I think is really critical when you start talking about taking the next step from being a 9-win-ish team to trying to actually win the Big 12 and get yourself into a playoff and thus competing for a national championship.
And as far as the leadership aspect, I mean, with Sam, I just think that stuff comes so naturally to him. I mean, you know, the junior days Texas has had, all these recruiting events he's heavily involved in. You know, I'm sure the coaches ask him to show up, but I doubt they have to twist his arm too much to show up to those events. I mean, you see him, you know, I'm hovering around outside the football offices at these recruiting events. I mean, he's just always out there interacting with, you know, other players and teammates and recruits. You know, I go back to when Tom Herman first got the job, and I think Almar can speak to this probably better than I can, but, you know, Herman fell in love with Ellinger immediately as the alpha, you know, before he'd really ever done it. I don't think he'd even practiced yet, if I remember correctly, but just fell in love with him. And, you know, we've seen that come to fruition over the next couple of years. But you're right. I mean, there's always progress to be made. I mean, can he do what Vince and Colt did and really take command of this team? I think we're seeing it, but there's still steps that need to be made and still needs to be backed up on the field next year. But boy, it sure certainly feels like he has complete command of the leadership role of this program to me.
Anwar, are you there?
Yeah. You want me to chime in on the leadership portion?
Yes. Well, because it was weird because I said I threw you the question and then Jason answered it. And then I didn't know if Jason answered it because you went mute again or and so, yeah, so I was just like going back to that original point. Anwar, your thoughts kind of and Jason, you're right, though, like Sam's already doing it. I just want to hear to what lengths it happens. Right. Like I can remember all the stuff that like. I know that as recent as a year ago that the people in the building on war were like, hey, it's a new day and we're not exactly doing it exactly the same way that it would have been done in the past. So like 7-on-7 isn't as critical as it might have been because we want to be the ones doing the evaluating and we don't want. OK, I get that. However, it would still be my contention and I have never ever changed on this. I've said this every year that we've worked together, like the quarterback. Because I've seen it with my own eyes. I've seen championship teams. I've seen great players. And I've seen how they do it. And I've never seen it done with these eyes in this town any other way. So, like, there's still, like, even another level for me that Sam can go as a leader for this program. And I think in a way that Herman would advocate for. And I think that opportunity is there. And I'm just curious to see how he goes about this responsibility, because one of the questions I want to ask you guys a little bit later is what the hell is the bar for this season? And what represents in 2019 like a poor season? Because, you know, we're going to get this August and September and the buzz is going to be incredible. And I'm curious what would represent failure given the leap that this team made in beating Georgia in the Sugar Bowl. But just back to the quarterback thing.
So a second item for my war room was talking about a Sam Ellinger as a leader. And so thank you again, Ketch.
I'm either ruining it for you or I'm putting it on a tee. I can't tell which one.
I don't know. We'll figure it out. But you know, the one thing I was talking to some people this week and kind of asking about that thing and Sam as a leader. And the one thing they've told me, it was communicated to me, was that Sam as a leader has never been in doubt, has never been in question. All he's really needed to do is to have the opportunity to play. You know, even after his freshman season, everyone identified with him as the leader of the team. So that's not an issue, and I don't think that'll come as a surprise. The challenge that it appears that they want, and it's hard to implement this portion of it, but the challenge that is going to be put on Sam this year is to be not just the leader of the offense, but the leader of the entire team, you know, including the defense portion of it. Now, it's hard because during game days, those things are like two ships passing in the night, right? The offense is meeting at one point, defense on the field, but they want that to carry over. They don't want it just to be he's done great on the offense and now it's up to the defensive guys. They want him to be the overall, you know, clear-cut leader of both sides of the ball. How that happens, I don't know if anyone has the specific formula for that. But if they had a goal for him this year of something to achieve, that would be the goal.
Let's turn that attention towards – I'm just curious. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this. Anwar – What would be failure in 2019?
Well, I mean, I think clearly, I think if you take too many steps back, so if you're at the 8-win kind of mark, 7-8-win kind of mark, I think that would be, after 10 wins, would be somewhat of a failure. And really, you know, could have been more, could have been less. You know, I know you could always play that game. I don't like to play that game. But to some degree, I think if you're back at the Texas Bowl at the end of the year, then you would be kind of considered maybe a failure. You know, maybe if your bowl game is San Antonio, Sugar Bowl, beyond that, obviously, that would be considered a success. I think the Texas Bowl is kind of like that consolation prize that most Texas fans don't want and don't really care about and don't get up for. So that to me would probably be any amount of wins that result in this team being a Texas Bowl would probably be considered a failure.
Jason?
I'm going to grade it a little more harshly than Anwar, I think. I don't think they have to win the conference. I don't think it's a failure if they make the conference title game again and, you know, lose. But, I mean, I think that would be disappointing to most fans. I wouldn't call it a failure, certainly. But I think anything less than winning the conference, you know, and that includes the championship game, I think that's – I hate to say failure, but I think that's disappointing. And that's – the bar to me this year is winning the conference championship. Do that.
It's a failure. So what's a failure, though, Jason?
Failure, not making the conference championship game. Anything less than that's a failure to me.
Dustin, jump in here as a bit of a tiebreaker or so. Like the 2019 season for the Texas Longhorns would be because we all know what a success would be. That's the easy part. What would represent failure?
I'd say, including the bowl game, if they don't get to 10 wins, I think that would be a failure. Of course, you had to factor in what are those final couple games. Is it a Big 12 championship game? Is it another bowl like the Sugar Bowl? That would kind of change things a little bit. But I think that the bar for this team, including a bowl game, is 10 wins. I don't know if not making the Big 12 championship would be a failure, but I think that it would create a lot of disappointment. I mean, the fan base's bar for this team next year will be to get to the Big 12 championship game. And I think if they don't make that and they don't find a way to 10 wins in this season, I think that's definitely not a step in the right direction. I think that would be a failure.
I'm exactly in tune with Jason, not making the Big 12, because you could get to the Big 12 championship game. You could be undefeated and get to the Big 12 championship game and lose. And I don't think, you know, if you're playing Oklahoma in the Big 12, and I think Oklahoma can say this about Texas now, like if you get to the championship game and your fate is you lose a close game, like that could happen. It doesn't necessarily mean you had a bad year. It just means you didn't win the championship. If Texas doesn't get to the championship game, then that would be a step backwards from what they did this past year. And I think in a way that would represent a small form of regression, even if it was they finished third or something like that. So I think they absolutely have to get to the Big 12 championship game. And then for the season to truly be a success, they've got to win that. Like that's the new degree of success. I don't think this is a fan base that would view anything less than that as a success, unless they go, I don't know, 10-2, 11-1, didn't get to another Sugar Bowl type game and walk away with a win. And then if you're talking about an 11 or a 12-2 or a 11-3 type season, but you ended it with a Georgia type win in a bowl game, like I think at that point you would say that was a damn good year. We just didn't win the championship. But I think anything less than that, and like I think Tom Herman starts to in year three starts to enter a new phase of expectations, which is they've now seen him do a certain thing. And when that doesn't happen, Texas fans can be hard on guys. Like that's the job. Believe me, Mack Brown had a lot of 10 win seasons and Texas fans were never happy until they won a championship of some variety. Holiday Bowls and Alamo Bowls and Cotton Bowls weren't quite enough.
I hear what you guys are saying. So since I'm probably in the minority, so to speak, I just want to throw this out there. Just for, you know, and you may be shocked because I understand Texas fans always have high expectations. Even after Charlie's bad years, it would still be high hopes that Texas would rebound and win a Big 12 championship. I always get that, right? But I still go back and I just think, you know, what are they going to have? Three new starting offensive linemen this upcoming season. You look at, they're going to probably have to have who's going to start at running back? You still have that question mark. Little Jordan Humphrey's gone, so you still got to fill that void. You're going to have a new tight end. Andrew Beck is gone. I look at the defense, and what are we talking about? Maybe two returning starters at this point, and then a whole bunch of – I mean, there's a lot of positions and shoes to fill. If it ends up being just an automatic plug-and-play, no problem. I see it, and I'll say, okay, they plugged and played, and it's fine. I just don't know, and I'm just being honest. I don't know if it's just that an easy of a, well, all these guys are gone, but the next group of guys will be just as good, if not better.
Yeah, but Oklahoma has to replace four offensive linemen. Like, everybody in the league has got to replace guys.
Bottom line is you have a quarterback coming back. That's what gives me confidence.
Yeah, other than Oklahoma, there's no other team in the conference that you would look at and say, well, their returning pieces are better than Texas's, or their questions are somehow less than Texas's. At worst, Texas comes into this season as the number two team in this conference. So again, not getting to the conference championship game. I think, Anwar, and maybe this isn't what you're saying, so maybe I'm phrasing it wrong. This fan base will be, it won't be fun on Orange Bloods. Like, people are going to be pissed if this team doesn't at least get back to the Big 12 championship game. And if they do get to the Big 12 championship game and they lose, then there will be an entirely new dialogue about how Tom Herman can't beat. Trust me, I have seen this before. I've been to this rodeo, which is why this is a really interesting season, because it may very well be that Tom Herman and his staff have got it cooking to such a degree that they exceed expectations, because, they could. Like, I don't look at this team as a playoff team, but if they win the Big 12, they put themselves into a position to be that kind of a team, and I would say that would exceed my expectations to a certain degree. I've got my eye clearly planned. I'm not thinking, as someone covering this team, I'm still not thinking playoff. I'm thinking get back to the game that you just lost and win that, because you're literally that close. And the team that just beat you for that championship is replacing the Heisman Trophy winner, possibly the number one pick in the draft again. And they've got a bunch of question marks, and they've got questions about whether or not they can just slot guys in and add water, instant success at teams. So this one's interesting for me, just because I don't think Texas fans have given it a ton of thought yet. I think that's the kind of thing that will happen over the course of the next few months and everything else. But my expectations are that this fan base is going to expect Texas to be competing in a Big 12 championship game. And they'll say, I think, in advance that they might not get mad if they get there and don't win it, because, again, anything can happen in a one-game setting. But I think there's a little bit of delusion there. I think the Texas entitlement amongst the fan base that it's either championship or bust, you're either moving forward or you're moving backwards. I think that, we haven't seen this program be good and then have to handle success and build off of that. Jesus, I don't know. I mean, 2008, when Texas went in a little bit of a rut and there were questions, then they bring in Will Muschamp and everything kind of changed with the program, at least immediately. I don't know. Like, it's been a decade since we've covered a Texas team that's coming off of what is being thought of as a really good year. Then what? And, this place can devour its own at times. So, I don't know. Have I won you over at all, Anwar? Or, like, are you?
No, because I'm looking at a team that's going to have potentially, like, what, 16 new starters or 15 new starters this year. I mean, again, let's just can we do the simple math and help me out? Like, so, Sam Ehlinger is back, right? So you got your one. You have two guys on the offensive line. So you have Cosme, and then you got Shackelford. You've got Colin Johnson. We don't know who's at running back. So
you've got Duvernay.
So you're at five. You got
Keontae a returning starter, wouldn't you, at this point?
Yeah, Keyontae Ingram's a returning starter.
Co-starter, if you will, but yeah.
So if you add him with the...
But he was our leading rusher, right?
So add him with the two... I mean, he wasn't a starter, but, I mean, if you want to say he's a starter, he wasn't a starter last year. But if you throw him in, that's eight returning starters out of your 22. They may be at plug and play. I'm probably going to take more of a wait and see. I guess for me, I just can't put that expectation on the team. It's not to say it won't happen, right?
I mean, at this moment, what's your preseason prediction for this team?
Oh God, I think they could do 9 and get 10 with a bowl.
Oh my God! You're people are going to revolt against you when they listen to this podcast.
But if they listen to what I'm saying, I'm just saying I want to see it. That's all I'm saying. I'm just saying it's a lot of
the Jason Sukumel approach.
There's a lot of things that you have to plug in, and you're still going to have to play a lot of young guys. So that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying it won't happen. I'm not saying it can't happen. I know people will just grab the one nugget and then and just start a thread and just bash me from there. If you just look at it objectively and saying they have to plug in that many new starters, and by the way, you face like LSU in week two.
Don't think this team should be ranked in the preseason top 10?
I'm not on mute. I'm thinking.
No, I got you. That would have been a hell of a mute, by the way.
I know they're going to be ranked in the top 10. I don't know if they're a top 10 team at this moment. I just don't know. I don't know.
Two reasons for me. I give them in honor. I totally understand where you're coming from. Usually I'm the guy who says, look, man, you got to replace this guy. There's no way to not take a step back when you had to replace whatever, Malik Jefferson and Puna Ford. I mean, it took Texas a while and that defense got cooking. But when I look at all the holes, I'm like, it's impossible not to expect them to take a little bit of a step back in some areas, certainly in the beginning. But two areas that give me confidence they'll be able to manage it. You have a returning quarterback who's extremely talented. Texas hasn't had that luxury in forever. That can mask a lot of other issues. And B, they've recruited so well. I think they've got young talent that's just waiting to jump in and explode. It may take those guys a couple weeks to kind of find their footing, but I think over the course of the season, I think they've got the talent to fill most of those voids.
Well, the players lost discussion, like they lost some guys, but how many true big time difference makers did they lose? I mean, Aminihu, Lil Jordan Humphrey, Gary Johnson. Okay. I mean, you had some guys like Calvin Anderson and Trey Watson that were solid veteran players, but it's not like they're going to lose, two round picks to the NFL draft. I just think that if you kind of looked at it as like a replacement level perspective, you're probably going to get similar production in most of those spots to what they had last year. Now, it might take some time. As Jason said, replacing Puna Ford didn't just happen overnight. It took some time for guys to find their roles and so on and so forth. But they've recruited so well. And if you look at just the trajectory of coaches when they take this type of job, and if they're going to be the guy that ends up winning a lot of games, there's usually a natural progression, and year three is usually the one where you really start to see programs start to take off. And it makes sense. They've probably got their culture established. If they've won games, they've got multiple recruiting classes in there. They're starting to get their type of player. They've probably got the quarterback position figured out. I think if we ask Tom Herman, when he's not on record, like, hey, if you don't win the Big 12 championship, is that somewhat of a disappointment to you? And I think that he would probably agree that this, the bar next year is they've made their progress. They were a little bit better in year one than they were when in Charlie Strong's last season. And then they were better in year two, making it to the Big 12 championship game and winning the Sugar Bowl. Now the next kind of step is to get back to that game and win that game. So, yeah, they're losing a lot of players, but a lot of teams lose players. And, besides guys like Aminihu, Gary Johnson, Lil Jordan Humphrey, I'm not sure they're losing a ton of production that's just going to be very, very difficult to replace. It's just going to be a matter of, a lot of these young guys are going to be in competition for those spots and who can emerge and provide that sort of production.
And to that point, though, I think, Anwar's point is fair in that, you know, I'm usually right there with Jason in that I've been very unwilling to give just flat out benefit of the doubt. I didn't do it last year when we would talk about the defense and Jason mentioned it, you know, when Malik leaves and is being filled by Gary Johnson. And, you know, I was very slow to say that doesn't automatically mean that production that Malik had is filled exactly to a T. Same thing with Puna Ford. I don't know. Maybe I'm just intoxicated with the talent that they have recruited in these last couple of recruiting classes. You know, I think that secondary on paper has a chance to be better than it was a year ago. You know, it depends on just how good you think Chris Boyd was last season and whether or not that can be replaced. Same thing with Devontae Davis. I don't know. It's funny because I think Anwar is fair to, I don't know, have his finger on the pause button to a certain extent. But I also think that Dustin's got this thing nailed exactly right, too, which is teams all over the place are having to replace players. I mean, Oklahoma, I would absolutely argue that Oklahoma has more to replace than Texas does. I mean, Kyler Murray, you take Kyler Murray off that, and I know they have a guy that I like be as their new quarterback, but if you take Kyler Murray off that team, and you put a different quarterback on that team last year, I think Texas wins the Big 12. And I don't know that Oklahoma makes the Big 12 championship game. Like, that is how big the loss of – that's how important Kyler Murray was. Oklahoma literally replaced the statistical great quarterback in the history of college football with the guy that, I guess, in one season replaced him. Like, that at some point, Texas learned this the hard way. Like, the bottom falls out on you at the quarterback position and you have to, you regress back to the middle. I just look at what Lincoln Riley has to replace at Oklahoma, quarterback position and almost that entire offensive line, which was the best in college football. Yes, Texas has to replace three starters, but you know, Zach Shackelford was the only guy on the offensive line that was all Big 12 last year, even if I didn't agree with that. And Sam Cosmi was their best player. So, you know, at least they're bringing back on paper their two best guys. I think the wide receiver position, like, I don't think they're going to miss little Jordan Humphrey next year. I think that production will be filled, even if there's not a guy exactly who's as good as little Jordan Humphrey. They just have so much talent at the wide receiver position that I don't expect that to be a problem. I just think there is more plug and play with this team than I've wanted to allow it to have. I haven't said that in a while, but I do think that this team's more plug and play than any that we've seen probably since the Mac heyday.
And I think that an issue with buying into Texas right now in that regard is it's been a long time since we've seen that at Texas. I can't remember the last, you know, somebody on the board asked, I forget who it was, like, when was the last time Texas has been in this situation where it's people are seemingly expecting so many young players to just step in and provide production. I can't remember the last time where they enter the season, you're just like, oh yeah, like this guy's going to do this. And, you know, they've got young guys here that are really talented to do this. And we just haven't seen that often at Texas. So it is, you know, it does cause some pause and like, okay, is, you know, are we going to get fooled again or is this group going to truly get over the hump? My deal is if you think Tom Herman's going to win a lot of games at Texas or have eventually the type of season that's a Big 12 championship type of season, I'm more willing to give them the benefit of the doubt heading into next year because of the way they've recruited, because of the progression that they've showed. And also, too, just kind of the landscape of the Big 12. I don't think the Big 12 is – you know, last year you had guys like Will Grier and Kyler Murray and all these other guys around the league. I just think that, you know, this is a winnable league. And at worst, Texas is going to be number two heading into the season in terms of Big 12 projections. And it's going to be a top 10 team. Whether that's fair or not, I'm not sure. But, I mean, that's where they're going to be heading into next season. I'm just willing to give those guys the benefit of the doubt based on what we've seen progression-wise so far in their two full seasons.
Dustin, that's a great point, real quick, because when we talk about not getting to the Big 12 championship game representing a disappointment, you know, last year Texas got there, and I thought the competition to get there, given that West Virginia did have Will Grier, was really intense. Who the hell's the number three team in the Big 12 coming into this season? Is it Iowa State?
I guess it would probably be Iowa State, yeah. I mean, TCU is has their issues. You know, Oklahoma State's a kind of a perennial eight-win type of team right now. I mean, they'll have their one season here or there where they win 10-plus games, but, you know, until proven otherwise, they're probably not going to be projected to be one of the top teams in the league. You know, Texas Tech, new coach. Kansas State, new coach. Kansas, new coach. You know, Baylor brings back their coach and a quarterback, but how good are they? So, yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot of coaching turnover in the league. A lot of quarterback turnover as well. That kind of goes back to, you know, Jason's point. Your Texas, you got to feel great about having Sam Ellinger back, especially as you look around the Big 12 landscape. Because, you know, not only is he one of the better returning quarterbacks in that league, he's probably one of the better returning quarterbacks in the country. So, yeah, I don't know. Off the top of my head, I couldn't predict who would be the third team in the Big 12 next season. I might be totally forgetting somebody, but there's been a lot of coaching turnover in the league this offseason.
Jason Anwar, any votes for – like, I don't know.
I don't either. I'm just – as Dustin talked it out, I mean, Iowa State – I mean, Baylor might be a sneaky pick, but I can't say I've broken down the rosters of all those teams enough to have a great pick. TCU is always a little scary because Patterson finds a way to bounce back quickly, but I can't think of any clear-cut team that I think, and whoever it is, it seems like a pretty significant step down from the top two spots, doesn't it?
It does. At least in almost in March, last day of February, months and months away before these teams start playing, It does feel like there's a gulf between, and it felt like there was a gulf to a certain degree between the top three last year and the rest. I don't know. Like Anwar, we've seen some riders in this market go gaga for Iowa State in the past. Did you see enough from Iowa State last year and Brock Purdy that you would feel confident enough saying, yeah, that's a Big 12 championship contender going into this season?
No, I think right now, the way the state of the Big 12 is for me, I think it's Oklahoma and Texas, and then there's just everyone else. And I think everyone else is fighting for second. You know, it's just a matter of, you know, I think it's a matter of Texas just avoiding the upsets, you know, throughout the season and just being able to start strong from start to finish. But, you know, if they do that and don't, you know, have the Oklahoma State letdowns, you know, the little games and Texas Tech letdown, things like that, it should be Texas and Oklahoma, I think, for one and two for the foreseeable future.
Anwar, I think the fan base is going to be, I don't know. I think they're going to be crazy high going into the season. And then I feel like whatever happens in that LSU game, you know, if they lose that game, I think Texas fans are like, okay, well, let's go win the Big 12. Let's get to the championship game. Let's see if we can, you know, get that off our back. If they win that game, oh man, they better make it to the Big 12 championship game because this place will go loony with their expectations, right? They'll be ready. They're ready for Bama and they're ready for Clemson, I think, based on the outcome of that game.
Well, yeah, because that game is going to – that game is – you're 100% correct. That game means Texas is talking about the national title because they're going to be ranked in the top 10, right? Yeah. LSU will be ranked in the top 10. Texas wins that game. They're instant top five. So now the conversation is about CFP. That's what the conversation is about. Now losing it, and then it's like, okay, well, you know, go ahead. You got Rice as you know, your get-back game, and then you start conference play versus Oklahoma State. So that's what winning and beating LSU puts everyone in talking about the national title race. A loss puts them back into talking about the Big 12 championship.
I mean, we know how this is going to play out. They're going to open the season against Louisiana Tech, and they're going to win that game, but it's going to frustrate fans the way they win that game. And then they're going to roll into the LSU game like a, you know, 4-point home underdog, and Herman's going to win. And because he just, as an underdog in big games, like it's like one of the best bets in college football. And then, like, it'll go from the – you know, the expectations will go from the Louisiana Tech game where it's like, oh, no, like this team's not as good as we thought it was going to be, and then the LSU game's going to happen, and it's going to be like, all right, playoff, here we come. Like, but you're right. I mean, if they win that game against LSU, that's going to be what the conversation's going to be. It's going to skip that level of, okay, let's begin with winning the league. It's going to totally jump that level to, all right, like, where are we going to be when the playoff standings first come out?
All right, Dustin, I'm looking at the clock. I realize we need to start wrapping this thing up a little bit. I'm giving you like a 2-minute warning.
Cool, I'll see you later.
I'm giving you a 2-minute warning. Jason, let's talk about recruiting for a moment. The rival, you know, this time last week we were talking about going into the event in Houston. I'm just going to give you the floor, kind of talk about your thoughts on recruiting. It's been kind of a slow week, but obviously over the weekend there's still a lot to kind of wrap up and talk about.
Slow week in terms of news, but I did hit the Rivals camp in Houston last weekend. I'll touch on that in a bit. Just looking forward to this weekend. Just a reminder, Parker Braun, the graduate transfer offensive lineman, will be on campus for an official visit. Jalen Kimber, a cornerback out of Mansfield Timberview, is coming in on Saturday. I was texting with him for an unofficial visit, and I was told by someone those are the only two visitors. So it won't be an action-packed weekend in terms of, you know, news and visits, but that Parker Braun visit's huge. I mean, you know, official visits, he'll be in with both of his parents. He'd be a key component for this Texas offensive line if Texas can win him over. But yeah, last weekend I was down at the Rivals camp down in Houston, and good talent turned out. I mean, there were a few more no-shows than I was expecting. It was a bit disappointing, but you had a lot of good players show up, including Zachary Evans. He didn't work out per se. He just went through kind of the warm-up stuff and didn't really do any one-on-one stuff, but I get it, man. He doesn't need to prove anything, and he's going to get his 5-star challenge invitation just by walking through the gate of the stadium. But, you know, I did get a chance to talk to Zach Evans quite a bit, and, you know, in talking to him, man, he's still genuinely pretty open. I mean, he told me several times, yeah, Texas is in a good spot, but I think genuinely he is undecided and is still keeping a pretty open mind until he takes some of these out-of-state visits. He mentioned Clemson. I'm telling you, man, watch out for Clemson. Do not sleep on Clemson. That's a school nobody's talking about in this one, but don't shut the door on Clemson. Alabama, Georgia, Texas A&M still involved there, LSU. I mean, literally, Zach could pick up the phone tomorrow and commit to any school in the country, but Clemson has not offered him yet, which is interesting. He was supposed to visit there a few weeks ago. It would have happened then. I mean, clearly they're just waiting to do it in person, make a big impression. But if some things come together, I think Clemson could be – I still think Texas gets Zachary Evans, but I think Clemson could be a thorn in Texas's side where they may make Texas have to sweat this out a little bit. You know, of course, Georgia and Alabama, those types are always going to be schools you have to watch out for. But talking to Zach Evans, talking to his brothers, two of his brothers were there. I spent some time talking to them. I really like Texas's chances. It just, everything about it makes sense in terms of depth chart, in terms of, you know, the offensive line recruiting, in terms of Texas, the program being on an uptick, obviously proximity. It just makes too much sense. I actually put my Rivals future cast in for Texas with Zach Evans, which is a little bit premature for me. I usually don't do that until I have a pretty good idea of where something's trending, but I just feel pretty confident, man. I think there's a long way to go in that one, and there's going to be a lot of twists and turns, but I think ultimately that road will turn back towards Austin in the end. So we'll see. Troy O'Meary, the wide receiver, Rivals 100 wide receiver, he was there. He was fantastic. He'll be on campus, not this weekend, he told me, but next weekend for a visit. A couple, you know, really good DBs. Jalen Jones, A&M commitment, was really good. I don't think there's much going on there between him and Texas. He told me he might take a visit, but I don't think there's much going on there. A few guys with offers that I think there's a good chance all three of these guys wind up in the Texas class. Rivals 100 safety Bryson Washington, he was there. Joshua Eaton, a corner that Texas just offered at the junior day a couple weeks ago. He's not looking to decide until February, but I feel pretty good about Texas's chances. Don't be surprised if something happens behind the scenes there at some point. Maybe he keeps it quiet, but I like Texas's chances there. Xavier Alfred was there. I'd say my biggest takeaway from this camp, though, man, was kind of weird. It was actually the 2021 offensive line group. Guys like Bryce Foster and Hayden Connor and Donovan Jackson, three guys who are all extremely high on Texas, three guys have been on the UT campus, seriously, 3, 4, 5, 6 times for some of those guys. Those three young offensive linemen were as good as anybody I saw. And it was just impressive. They all three punched their ticket to the Rivals 5-Star Challenge. You know, and then I came out of the thing thinking, hey, man, Texas already has three offensive line commits in the 2020 class. They're going to get a couple more. They're going to have a great 2020 offensive line recruiting class. Boy, if they can land 2-3 of those dudes that I just mentioned from that camp that performed so well there, I mean, Herb Hand's got this offensive line thing cooking all of a sudden. So good talent overall. You know, I didn't mention Vernon Broughton, of course, was there. Princely, Human Milan, a couple defensive ends. Again, man, I think if I'm betting money right now, I think both those dudes are in the Texas class at some point. It might not happen right away, but I think in time they're both going to be a part of the Texas 2020 class. So it was a good chance to see those guys in person, talk to a lot of them. This weekend, Nike has the opening camp up in it's in Frisco, north of Dallas, at the Cowboys practice facility. So I'll be up there, get a chance to see a lot of the DFW area talent, talk to those guys, and have more to talk about on those guys next week. But yeah, it was a productive week at the camp, or covering those guys at the camp. This weekend, Texas will have two visitors, and we'll be following the Parker Braun one. I'm going to talk to someone close to Parker this afternoon, and I should have a pretty nice preview of that one in the war room tonight.
Jason, you know, it's interesting coming out of the Houston camp and all the content that Rivals had. I thought it was really interesting to see the content piece where all the players picked where the other guys were going to go. I think the thing that stood out to me the most in all of that was how adamant that both Zachary Evans and Damian George were that they will each play with each other. Like, you know what I mean? Like Zachary right. Evans is like, he's going where I'm going. That's a fact.
Yeah.
I think that's a nice feather in the cap for Texas. Not to say that George couldn't end up very easily at a school like Clemson or something else. But anytime you start talking about legit package deals, and maybe that's not fair to call that this, but two guys that are on the same team could end up going to the same school and they want to go to the same school, usually that favors the in-state school, because now you're not talking about just one family that's got to get used to the idea of one of their kids going 2,000 miles away to college. But now you're talking about two families, whereas Texas is only 200 miles away for both of those kids. I think that's an interesting little detail to keep an eye on, because has George turned into a guy that has that level of offers yet? Like,
yeah,
I haven't. His offer list is similar to Evans.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like you. I don't like package deals necessarily, because usually there's one that's kind of riding the coattails of the other. But Damian George stands on his own merits. I mean, Texas.
No, I really know that, but I just hadn't noticed that his offer list.
Yeah. He's got Alabama. He's got all the big boys in the SEC. And in fact, you know, he doesn't have, though.
Like, he's got Alabama, and then he's got Penn State and Tennessee, and those are the only, and Florida State. And then, you know, he's got Oklahoma and he's got Texas and Texas A&M. And
it's a pretty good offer list. I mean, what else?
Yeah, but that's not the same as everybody. You know, Zach Evans has offers from, he doesn't have a Clemson offer yet.
Well, neither does Zachary Evans.
Interesting.
That's
weird.
Yeah, he will. I mean, as soon as he visits there, he'll get his offer, but he didn't have it yet. But yeah, Damian George, I mean, he could pick up the phone. Listen, Clemson, Alabama, Georgia, they'd all take him tomorrow. He's that good. And plus, they know it would help them with Zachary Evans. But George is an interesting dude, man. A, he doesn't have a phone, so he's hard to get much information out of him.
Wait, what? Don't bury the lead.
Yeah,
he
does not have a phone, man. I searched for a phone number for him forever, and finally I hit up his coach. I was like, dude, how do I get in touch with him? And he said, hey, he doesn't have a phone. So you can DM him, but I don't even know how he gets on Twitter. But if he doesn't have a phone, how's he getting his DMs? I guess he has to literally be in front of the computer to respond or something. But he was a guy that a lot of people pegged as probably going to go out of state. Now, he did come in, 4 or 5 weeks ago now for that kind of elite junior day deal Texas had. It was the weekend of the Oklahoma home basketball game. Really had a good time there, I'm told. I think Texas really helped its chances. But you're right, him and Evans, it's not just lip service. I mean, those two want to play together, and I think they probably will play together at the next level. If Texas could get Damian George, get a guy like Chad Lindbergh, that would, A, round out their five-man offensive line class. B, I think that would maybe, I don't want to say wrap up Texas, Zachary Evans for Texas, but if you get Damian George and Chad Lindbergh, I think Texas's chances of landing Zachary Evans shoot through the roof. Now, the flip side of that, what if Damian George, you know, he kind of has been enamored with some of these out-of-state programs. If he goes to Alabama and falls in love and Alabama picks up the pressure on Zach Evans, could that sway Zach Evans out that way? Or you mentioned Clemson. If they both go visit Clemson this spring and Clemson offers both of them and they're blown away, you know, that could make things interesting out there. So landing Damian George, he's a tremendous talent. But, yeah, that would be a big development for Texas in the Zach Evans sweepstakes as well.
Let's jump into parting shots. I know we all have things we need to get to today. It sounds like Jason needs to get to Hutto. Jason, you want to go first, or was that your parting shot? You want to?
Yeah, I don't have much, man. Like I said, it's talked about the camp stuff. That's about all I've got, man. I don't have anything real earth shattering. I'll have, like I say, I hope to have a Parker Braun visit preview this weekend for this weekend's visit in the war room tonight. But yeah, I need to go make my way to lovely Hutto to get my teeth clean and take care of some other dental stuff. But yeah, I think that's about all I've got, man.
No cavities, no whammies, no cavities. All right.
Can't get cavities from Coors Light.
That's right.
Is that a fact? Do they put that on the can?
They should have.
I don't know. They should.
I'll be the spokesperson.
Anwar, do you have a parting shot?
Yes, but Dustin has to go to first. Yeah, I want to hear him talk about Shaka.
Oh, that's true. I tell you what, before we do the parting shots, because I did. Thank you, Anwar. I was just about to let that go.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
I'm just saying.
Thanks a lot. Let's rehash that basketball game, huh?
Even I'm going to hang out to listen to this one.
You guys have heard it 15 times already.
Oh, we haven't heard it after a loss like that.
So last night, I got to just tell you, before Dustin, you start talking, I was sitting, my daughter at a track meet, and I'm sitting there talking to an Orange Bloods guy, a buddy of mine, and he was talking about the basketball team and the game, and he goes, gosh, they're so frustrating. They're just so up and down. And then we're following the game as we're watching the track meet, and Texas is up big. And then, boy, was there ever just a them in a nutshell were talking about a program that's it's so frustratingly up and down. I mean,
Dustin, for 32 minutes, that was the best job of coaching that Shaka Smart maybe has ever done. Like in any game to be down two seniors and to be up as many points as they were and to go to the 8-minute timeout and there was no threat whatsoever. And then the threes just started raining. I don't know what Baylor shot in the final 8 minutes, but it seemed like they hit about 10 and maybe took about 12. Boy, that was – and then to lose the way they lost in overtime on a sketchy call. And it's not to say they still could have lost the game. I think Baylor was in a position to get a rebound and still get another opportunity to score on that possession, but they go to the – it was just – I don't, it felt like the most, it felt
was
like,
it was one of the best representations of the Shaka era that I think that we've seen, because like you said, I think we saw for about the first 25 to 30 minutes of that game, we saw Texas do every single thing that Shaka talks about over and over and over again, aggressiveness, confidence, like coming together as a team and rallying around one cause and diving on the floor for loose balls and being tougher than the other team and spacing the floor on offense and shooting the ball with confidence. Like all of these things were happening and they built this gigantic lead. And I mean, I'm not going to lie there. I knew Baylor was going to make a run at some point. In the back of my head, I'm thinking, okay, how close is this going to get to them blowing this? Because you knew that just somehow that game was going to find a way to be close because of all the other times that Texas has had close games and how they've played in them. But it was kind of the Shaka era summed up into one game. You see the potential and then you see the issues. Is that this team and this program just keeps finding ways over and over and over and over again to lose close basketball games. And it's just another example that if you take this game on its own, like if I would have told you, hey, they're not going to have Osakowski, they're not going to have Roach, and they're going to lose in overtime by one at Baylor, you'd probably say, well, you know, they probably played a little bit better than I thought they would. But then if I tell you, well, they shot 15 of 27 from three, led by 19 points with 14 minutes remaining in the game, and lost. And oh, by the way, they traveled with 7 seconds left when they had a lead in overtime. Like, they were up six in overtime. Like, you know, you just be like, oh, God, you know, here we go again. And it's just I just think that right now it's in this program's DNA that in these games they find ways to lose games. And it's just it's maddening to watch. And I don't know. I just felt like last night was a great example of just, you know, Texas basketball under Shaka Smart, in that you know, even going back to the game like the Oklahoma game where they, you know, they play like crap on defense in the first half and then they come roaring back. Like, we knew that was going to happen. We knew that they were going to end up losing a close game because we've seen it before. You know, we've seen the Baylor game kind of play out against Michigan State earlier this year. Texas played as good of a first half as I've ever seen a Shaka Smart team play. You know, had a lead in the second half, and then all of a sudden Michigan State makes their run, comes roaring back, and wins that game relatively easily. And we've just seen this story over and over and over again. And I don't know what changes this story. I don't think that there's, you know, what if they win a couple of these games, all of a sudden they're going to start as a program winning more of these games? I mean, we've just seen this happen so often that this is just Texas basketball. And we don't have evidence to think that that's going to change in the near future. And sure, they were undermanned, but you can't blow a 19-point lead anywhere on the road. And especially the way they did it with, you know, they get a clean look, a relatively clean look at the end of regulation. But really, they get back up six in overtime. And it was like that Nevada game in the NCAA tournament where – I think Roach had a 4-point play against Nevada in overtime, and then Coleman was making shots, and I'm sitting there on press row thinking, wow, they're actually going to win one of these for a change. These guys are making shots. They're playing with a ton of confidence. I mean, Febbers played out of his mind last night. Kamaka Hepa goes from concussion protocol to cleared to starting and playing 39 minutes in replace of Osakowski, and he hits a big three to put him up six, and you're thinking, okay, they're actually going to find a way to do this for a change. And then just Baylor, just every rebound that Baylor went for on the offensive end when they missed a shot was just a war. And those guys just ripped away rebounds for Texas. And it's one of my issues I had with that game was they basically played the same five guys the entire second half in overtime. And those guys, some of those guys look gassed. And if you're getting your ass kicked on the offensive glass, which that's what Baylor does. I mean, that's who they are as a team. At some point, you probably want to throw in Jericho Sims in there for a stint, or Royce Hamm, or play with two bigs. Or, and I know you don't want to take the shot making off the floor, but literally Baylor's offense was drive to the hole or shoot a three-pointer. And if we miss, either put it back in or kick it out for a three-pointer. I mean, how many times did that happen over and over and over again? Baylor grabbed 50% of its misses last night. 50%. That means one out of two shots that they missed, they got an offensive rebound for. I mean, that's just incredible. But it was just kind of the Shaka era summed up into one game last night, in that you saw the potential, you saw them do everything that they talk about, and then you saw them find a way somehow to lose a game that they led by 19 points in the second half. Yeah.
I was looking while you were talking at 8 minutes and 45 seconds left. You know, the ESPN predictive outcome thing, it had Texas's 98.9% chances to win that game.
Oh yeah,
99% chance to win that game.
It reminds me of that. I mean, I keep saying it reminds me of, because there's so many examples of this stuff. I mean, golly, it reminds me when they had that like 12-point lead at Oklahoma State last year with like 4 minutes left. I think that they were like a 98.2% chance of winning that game, and they lost that game. I mean, if you look at the KenPom graph. KenPom.com publishes like a win probability graph. You know, at one point, it looked like Baylor only had a 2.2% chance of winning. And in overtime, Texas, there was a point in overtime where Texas had a ninety-two point eight percent chance of winning in overtime. 92.8% in overtime, and they lost. And like
he said, it's happened before. When are we going to see these games start maybe going the other direction?
That's the thing. That's where Texas is right now. Like, you know, how do you just not have a program that's where it's just like they're so used to these things happening under, you know, this coaching staff? Like, how do you break that mold? I don't know. We're fourth year into this. Like, it's not something you can wave a magic wand at. It's not something that, you know, they've recruited different guys and whatever. Like, and the sad thing for Texas and its fans is, like, Courtney Remy was so good last night. I mean, that was a freshman guard that had 17 points, 10 assists, and a one-point guard got in Mario Kegler's face and basically told him, like, hey, I'm not backing down from you, and started talking shit to him. Like, that could be a guy that's like, oh, my gosh, like, there's our hope. Like, Courtney Remy playing with Matt Coleman in the future and yada, yada. And then they find a way to lose that game. Like, at this point, you just have to assume that this is going to be the outcome more often than not. That's just the way it is.
I think it's hilarious that Jason's going to miss the dentist because he hung around.
No, I'm leaving. I got to get out of here.
Talk about this Shaka
Smart
stuff.
Because you know what it feels like covering this team, pulling.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Like, from one excruciating experience to the other. On that note, I'm logging off, guys.
Yeah, your dentist trip will be much more enjoyable. Yeah. Trust me.
Nothing sweet on this end talking about. So, Anwar, I almost flinched to bring Anwar into the hoops conversation because Shaka is clearly not his guy. I have felt that, and Dustin, I want your thoughts on this too, because you're around it more than any of us. I felt like the first 3 years, Shaka himself didn't waver in confidence. Like, I always felt like Shaka felt like he was the right guy, and it, you know, it was circumstances more than anything that the reasons why the program hadn't taken off yet. This season, though, his body language on the court, like I see him get deflated by. So look, he's only human. I'm not telling him not to be, but yeah, Dustin, when you say how do you get things to turn around, what changes? He'll never admit this, and maybe he won't even admit it to himself. But I think that there's a confidence issue with Shaka now. And I didn't think that a year ago. I do think that now.
I think that this is the first season where he was totally convinced that they were going to break through. You know, because of the way last season went down with Andrew Jones and all of that stuff. Like, I think that they felt like, you know what? Like, it wasn't a season that we wanted to have. But it wasn't a bad year. You know, we had all these issues and so on and so forth. But heading into this year, he spoke about the team differently than any other team that he's had at Texas. There was a real belief that they were not only going to finish in a good place in the Big 12, but that they were going to make a run in the NCAA tournament. And I mean, that he just spoke about them with a confidence that I hadn't seen before. And I think that, you know, that deflation aspect is, I think that he is, I don't know if it's surprised or caught off guard or shaken or I don't know what it is, but this is not playing out at all like he thought it would. You know, them being, you know, if I would have told him, hey, at the beginning of the year, I told him, hey, you're going to be, you know, 15-13 and you need to win two of your final three games to feel good about getting the NCAA tournament. He would look at me like, no way, no chance that happens. I mean, they had a real belief that this team was going to really break through just with the combination of finally have a couple of seniors, the incoming recruiting class, Coleman back, you know, Febris, you know, making the next step as a shooter, all of those things. I think that's why you see him so deflated sometimes, is that they were convinced that this group was going to break through, that this was going to be the breakthrough after the year, you know, with Andrew Jones having leukemia last year, kind of, you know, derailing last season and all that sort of thing, that this was going to be the group that's like, all right, it finally clicks. We're finally going to get this thing going in the right direction. And it's turned out to be probably the most frustrating year he's had at Texas. You know, because I don't think they ever thought that they're going to be good his second year. But they thought that they were going to be good this year. And to see it play out like this, yeah, I think you're right. I think he wears it on his face sometimes. You know, this is a guy that early in his career, and I'm not sure if he still does this. I haven't looked to notice, but he would take a Sharpie and write a plus sign on his hand as to remind himself to look down to remain positive at all times. You know, that was kind of his way of, you know, being that, you know, hyper positive, energetic guy. And now it's just, you can see it on his face. It's just crushing because they totally believed that this group was going to be one that would win 20 plus games and be in a position to make a deep run in the NCAA tournament. And now they're playing for their NCAA tournament lives, the final three games of the season.
I mean, Ketch, you know, the job is just too big for him right now. I think it may not be a right now. It just may be it's just period. Job's just too big for him. I think that whatever made him successful at VCU does not translate here at Texas, does not translate in the Big 12. Whether he's been able to recruit well, but I don't think he's been able to properly identify guys who will, you know, excel over a 2-3 year period and will progress and get better to give them that kind of camaraderie. And whatever happened there is so far in the past. And I think the other thing that really hurts with Shaka is that he came in at the same year with Charlie, and Charlie was a failure. And I think that he's also tagged along with those hires from Steve Patterson. And so I think that compounds that, because I think he gets the he's failing, but I think it's also the reminder that he came in with Charlie and Charlie also failed too. And so I just think at this point, you're looking at a guy that's going to miss, am I saying this correct, could potentially miss his third straight NCAA tournament?
No,
third overall. I apologize, third overall.
No, they missed it his second year, but they made it the first year and the third year.
Okay, so he'll miss his second potentially and still doesn't have an NCAA win to his record. I mean, at this point, I mean, this biggest benefit that he has is that Texas just doesn't want to cut ties and doesn't want to lose the money. But if he's at a basketball school, he does not have a job because for whatever reasons, it's just too big for him. You could say a lot of these losses are close, but at some point you've got to be able to break through some of it. And it's just not a good fit.
Yeah, I the fit thing I think is I think that we're seeing that play out this year. Especially he wears it on his face sometimes in just the energy surrounding the program right now. I have to think that when he took this job, this is obviously from a results standpoint, it's not what he envisioned, but I think also in terms of an energy around the program standpoint, I don't think he envisioned this sort of thing at all. And it's crazy too, like if I would have told you, hey, they finished 89th in offense last year and that was everybody's gripe, and like, oh, hey, they're going to be, with three regular season games left, they're going to be 25th nationally in offensive efficiency, you probably would have thought, whoa, like, okay, they actually figured some things out. And you know, here they are, 15-13.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Like, they're number two in the Big 12 in offensive efficiency, number two. And you know, they're 7-8 in the league and 15-13 overall. It's just, it's so confusing. I mean, well, not confusing, but there's so many like weird things to point to. Like, they should be much better than they are in terms of record, and they're just not. They just find a way to lose basketball games.
Real quick on the basketball front, and then we'll go and finish up our parting shots. Chris Beard. In your mind, is that the next head coach at the University of Texas?
That's a great question. You know, he's got a tricky contract. I haven't seen all the details, but Texas Tech likes to make their guys have a clause that basically jacks up the price big time if they make a move to a Big 12 program. It's one of the reasons why Tim Tadlock was never really a realistic candidate at Texas, because that just, that whole thing was just a turnoff. Like, they weren't going to pay, you know, whatever it was, $1 million or whatever, and then a buyout to get a guy like that. So that element's tricky, especially if we're to assume that Texas would have to pay, you know, a Shaka buyout as well. But and I posted this on Orange Bloods in a, I think, a beard thread earlier this week or whatever. Like, if you're, if you stick your ear in the you know, the conversations at some AAU events and coaching carousel and all those things, it sounds like Chris Beard would have a very big interest in the Texas job. And at that point, it would just probably become, you know, Texas making it happen if that opening were occurred. But I think if you made me pick a guy right now, I think that probably that would be the guy that makes the most sense and the most realistic, because I do think that there would be some interest there.
He's a Texas grad. He got a start under Penders as a GA at Texas. I have to believe that he would be a hot name. There's part of me that wonders, does he just sit tight and pull like a like the dude at Wichita State? You're just waiting for, or even Shaka to a certain extent, right? Like, you were told that you're going to have all these big time offers come your way, and it's about choosing the one that you want. That dude's going to have an offer from somebody, I have to believe, after this year. I just wonder if Texas misses the train on that one, if timing ends up being a less miles to Michigan type thing, or if it just all kind of comes together. I feel like that dude has proven he's really good, and if Texas misses out on him, I just wonder who the next guy is, and I'm not so sure it's obvious. Is there a second obvious one to you?
I don't think there's a second obvious one to me. I'm as I said before, I'm a big Eric Musselman guy, but I don't know if that's an obvious one, just because he does have kind of a, you know, different personality, and, you know, his antics have kind of gotten him in trouble in the past. I don't think there's another obvious one. And, you know, the one thing about the college basketball landscape is I don't foresee a lot of big time jobs opening. I know UCLA is open, but I don't think that that job has the allure that, that it's, you know, championship passage should suggest it has. I just don't think it's looked at as a, like, top tier job. I think if tomorrow the Texas job was open and the UCLA job is open, I think a vast majority of college coaches would say that the Texas job is a better job than UCLA. So I don't foresee a bunch of really, really good opportunities opening up, you know. And a guy like Beard, like, he's got it rolling at Texas Tech. And so much of a challenge for these coaches in college basketball is really getting a culture established, a winning culture, you know, recruiting stuff, all of those things. And, you know, once you have that, it's hard to walk away from that. I mean, just, you know, look at Shaka, how many times he turned down stuff at VCU, because they had it rolling there. And to a point that there's so much comfort and familiarity, and the results keep coming in, that it's hard to step away from that. But I don't foresee a job opening that Chris Beard is going to leave Texas Tech for this year. I could see him just kind of waiting and waiting to, you know, in a simple situation where it's like, okay, like, these are the types of jobs that I won't pass up if they come open. But if they don't open, I'm just going to stay here at Texas Tech and keep this thing going.
Anwar, parting shot.
Well, thank you, Dustin.
I gave you what you wanted.
Well, we just can't leave that elephant in the room unaddressed. I'll just give you parting shots, plural, just a couple of scattering of my thoughts. NFL Combine is clearly this week. As I always say, my PSA, don't believe the hype. I know every draft expert and analyst is going to tell you, guys stock rising, guys stock falling, blah, blah, blah. At the end of the day, the majority of teams already have their draft board set. The majority of teams are here for physicals. And even if a guy does well in the combine, they're still going to go back and look at the film. So don't get too caught up in that hype. Poor Josh Rosen, because he just found out that Kyler Murray's 5'10". And that pretty much means that he's going to be out of a job. I'm sure he wants a remeasure on that one, but it's not going to happen. I will still be amazed that even at the NFL Combine catch, there will probably be at least two guys that fail the drug test. We'll find out about that probably before the draft at some point. But it's still always going to be amazing to me that you know what's coming, you know what to expect, and yet you're just going to put it down. I think Colin Johnson will be at the NFL Combine next year, 1,200 yards, 12 touchdowns for him. Robert Kraft, man. Hey, dude, you're a billionaire. Can you go to the Playboy mansion like most billionaires do and get your women? Because you're doing it kind of wrong and doing it the wrong way. I realized that Vince Carter was still in the league. I did not know this until this morning when I saw some highlights on ESPN. Dude is 42 years old. Ketch, what are you and I doing with our lives? Because clearly we're doing it the wrong way. And by the way, for you Texas little nugget, still waiting on David Beatty. Not quite sure what the holdup is. There's something going on legally, and no one wants to give me the details. So when that gets out worked out legally, if it does, he'll be here as an analyst. If it does not, then he'll just sit around and collect checks until he takes his next coaching job.
Man, I'm not going to – like, you and we could do more – but I'm not like Vince Carter. I'm not, the bar is not Vince Carter. Like he's an alien. He's an alien.
He's 42.
He's a 42 year old alien. 42 is the new 18 in Mars.
So what does that make us then?
We're human. We're human. What 42 year old other than Vince Carter is doing Vince Carter things in the NBA. Kobe didn't make it to 42. Jordan didn't make it to 42. LeBron might make it to 42.
Possibly, but his body's clearly broken down this year.
Like I said, Vince Carter's an alien. Like I let Larry Bird at 42 be the bar for you and I.
I mean, the guy played with Tracy McGrady, and Tracy McGrady's in the Hall of Fame. Like this is amazing. I didn't even know. I thought he had retired years ago.
No,
I did not. I literally know that. I'll admit some sports ignorance here. I did not know that.
He was on that 94-95 Carolina team?
saw Vince Carter play in college at the Irwin Center.
I know.
Rasheed Wallace.
Dude, I was in Florida. I knew about Vince Carter in high school. People would talk about him. This guy from Daytona Mainland, his name is Vince Carter, man. He is legit. Like, he had a name that carried way before the internet. And maybe it's post-high school, but still heard his name.
Wasn't that Olympics where he jumped over the guy, like the 2002 Olympics or something like that?
It was the 1984 Olympics.
The guy's still in the league. This is amazing. It's an amazing. I'm amazed by this. I'm amazed by this. I'm amazed because I literally thought that the guy was just, I never even thought twice about him until I saw him. I'm like, wow, Vince Carter is still playing.
Let me tell you what, because, you know, if you ever watch The Jump on ESPN, it's one of my favorite shows that I DVR and watch every day. Tracy McGrady comes on there all the time. And they always do like this day in NBA history, and they'll do a highlight. I swear every other highlight they do week in and week out is Vince Carter dunking ridiculously on somebody. So, and then they'll always point out like he's still in the league. So yeah, I did know that in part because The Jump shows so many of his dunk highlights every single day. Vince Carter is a national treasure. I don't know that we fully love him as much as we should. Dustin, do you have any other parting shots? I feel like we wiped you out with Shaka Talk.
No, not nothing more. Was Vince
Carter? You want to talk about the baseball game from last night?
Here's a thought: don't walk 10 guys and don't commit 4 errors. Because if you do that against LSU this week and you're losing by 12 runs instead of 7 or 3 runs against UTSA. Was Vince Carter in the story about the Yao bounty in the Olympics? I think he was on that team where it came out recently that the Olympics put $1 million bounty on Yao Ming. If you dunked on him, you got $1 million. Like, I think he was on that team as well. Oh, it's like you can't say anything about basketball like with Vince Carter. Like, oh, remember when Vince Carter played with Bill Russell way back in the day? Like, he's all over the place. But yeah, nothing to add on baseball.
I'm looking here. It says Vince Carter report. Vince Carter tried to win $1 million dunk bounty on Yao Ming.
Yeah. Like, imagine having that ability that, like, okay, cool. Yeah, I'm going to go try to dunk on this 7'6" guy in a game and win $1 million. Like, it's – I mean, that's just incredible.
That's amazing.
Well, I'm telling you, I saw Vince Carter play with Rasheed Wallace for North Carolina at the Irwin Center. I think it was like 1995. 95 or 96?
That sounds right, yeah. I think they were both on those teams.
And Brandy Perryman hit a three – late in the game, and I want to say Texas won like 55-54. And I think I interviewed Dean Smith that day. That's how long ago it was. I think I guess Guthridge would have been in by then. I'm trying to remember when Dean Smith stepped down. Maybe it wasn't.
I think he coached Rasheed and Vince Carter. I don't think that was until like 97, 98 when he was done.
Because I interviewed Dean Smith, and I can't imagine I would have done that if he wasn't coaching. So, yes, that's how long ago he is. He
95. I'm looking here. It's December. I'm looking up something here. Sonny Alvarado posts 20 points and 14 rebounds to lead Texas to a 74-72 upset of number 11 North Carolina. Is that the game?
That's it.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Because Dean Smith's last game last season was 97. So he was still coaching all those guys.
I think it was Texas has always had North Carolina's number. This game at the Irwin Center was played in the 50s. And I remember Brandy Perryman hitting the big three. It's true. I'll have to look it up. I'll have to go on the old school Texas archives and find that box score. Anyway, I only have one parting shot. Dustin, are you good? I've forgotten what we were doing.
No, I'm good. Go for it.
So, you know, they're coming out with the combine measurements and everything. And that is typically, I don't care about that stuff. I mean, other than we were all waiting to see Kyler Murray and what he would measure in at. And that boy must have been stretching for the last few months. I feel like they've been hanging him upside down from his toes to get him to 5'10", but good for Kyler Murray. Not so good for Hunter Renfro. I feel bad for bringing this up, but he has baby hands. And like, let me either one of you that are still with me on this podcast, I only know this because Alex talks about hands all the time and measuring hands. And so I've become like a novice of, oh, there's somebody with 10-inch hands, and Alex will like get excited about that. Like, so I've come to know that, you know, hand size in the NFL, like what's a good hand size? Is everybody somewhat familiar with the hand size and like what teams, what Alex would like get off on for hand size?
I don't know. I don't know what Alex's standard is for that.
He loves like nine. Who did he? He was talking about somebody in the last podcast that he wanted to measure their hands at one of the junior days, and the guy had like nine and a half inch hands or something like that. Do you remember that, Dustin? Well, anyway,
Dustin.
Hunter Renfro measured at the combine today with 7-inch hands, like seven hands. He doesn't quite make it to 8 inches on the hands. And I have to believe that makes him – that's the smallest hand I've ever seen at the combine. And then I start thinking about all of, like, jokes that people make for my entire life. You know what they say about guys with big feet and big hands? I do. You know what they say about dudes with little hands? So I feel like now Hunter Renfro is going to walk around and everybody's going to know, like, he's got little baby hands, like little Trump hands.
Wow.
This is where
the party shot is going.
He's got like baby Donald Trump hands. And I just think that that's unfair for him, that that's going to get publicized. The guy has a national championship ring, two of them, right? And yeah, at the end of the day, though, like apparently when he gets a ring, he needs one from one of the little, you know, 25-cent machines because his fingers are so small. But he can catch the football. But I just know that was my parting shot. In the middle of this podcast, I saw that his hands were so small, I thought it was a misprint, and it's not. Let me put it to you like this. every receiver that they measured today at the combine had at least 9-inch hands from what I saw in the measurements. And Hunter Renfro's hands are less than 8. I mean, it's like shaking the hand of a third grader. Anyway.
Well, those women in the bars and clubs who are trying to come up are not going to care at the end of the day. As long as the check is there, they'll work with it.
Oh, that's true. You know, I used to go out with a guy. True story. This will be my parting shot. I used to hang out with a guy. Not really hang out. I just knew him. We were acquaintances more than anything else. But his rap at bars was to tell women that he was not endowed in the nether region, that he was quite the opposite. He would tell women at bars that he had a small male member. And if you thought that that would go poorly for him, it didn't. I knew this guy to hook up with more women than just about anybody that I knew. And it always seemed like they wanted to find out for themselves if it was as small as he said it was. Party shot for the day.
Wow.
Saying that the women at Dallas Nightclub never frowned upon it.
They were curious. They wanted to know if it really was a micro penis, is what you're saying.
He would tell them, like, yeah, nothing down there to brag about. Actually, nothing at all. And then I would find out later, like, yeah, he was telling the truth. Weird stuff. Anyway, that is the ticket. No, so Hunter Renfro is, I'm sure, perfect.
Here is our sponsor.
Thanks to everybody.
This parting shot sponsored by Viagra.
1-800-SOLD-OUT-TicketCity.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on the Ticket City podcast do not necessarily reflect the thoughts and the opinions of those associated with Ticket City, just the lame brains over at orangebloods.com. For myself and Jason, who we hope doesn't have, who missed the back end of the podcast and will regret it because this was right up his alley. for Dustin, for Anwar, who doesn't necessarily think Texas should be ranked in the top 10 and wants to hear your... That's exactly how I'm teasing this podcast, by the way.
Thanks. Thanks.
And for Alex, who's on his 18th shrimp cocktail in Indianapolis, and I'm sure he'll have an Indianapolis scouting review rant next week for us. Thank you for listening. You guys be good to each other.